And welcome back, everybody. We're talking with Patrick Henningsen from 21stCenturyWire.com about the roots of the ISIS crisis. And I want to begin to talk a little bit more about Israel now and their hand in this particular conflict, but also really the other ones. We've seen, just prior to this, we've seen a massive onslaught on Palestinians in Gaza. There's been a tremendous conflicts, really, one after the other, as I said before in the first hour, really, that almost too much to keep up with, really. But the question is how much damage a small country like this can make, of course, and the way that they have, you know, their tentacles in everyone's business. We talked a little bit about, you know, Hezbollah, but there's also the Hamas, you know, kind of question and scenario. I remember a couple of articles going back to the fact that they spoke about the Israel's or the Mossad's involvement in the creation of Hamas. It's kind of the same thing here, whether today or not it's a genuine organization, but it didn't begin with that. As we know, things, you know, transform throughout time. New people come in, things, wear out or what have you, or taken over by, you know, other people with other intentions. So it's not, it doesn't speak anything of it now. If we have something that stands for many, many years, things do change along the way, right? But nonetheless, Israel has had a tremendous influence over so many of these events, Patrick. And what's your view on this? If we look at both the ISIS again situation, we can talk more about that certainly, but also with Palestine, with Hamas, and what you believe that their kind of ultimate goal is here. Is there a religious incentive here, as some say? I remember watching a documentary, it was a short video by a gentleman who spoke a little bit more of the religious side of the Zionist fervor that exists right now as well in Israel and the religious nature of this. And even it spoke about the targeting of, for example, Christians, as we've kind of seen under ISIS. We've seen, he mentioned there's going to be a later kind of incursion into, of course, the Muslim world. There is a threat there as well. But even Europe in itself, it's part of the targeting in this process. And I think we've seen just an escalation on so many fronts on this particular issue. How do you view this, Patrick?
Well, with regards to Israel, you know, if you study the history of the formation of Israel, you probably can understand that Israel's destiny was locked into place in the violent fashion which it carved out its initial state. So we're talking about ethnic cleansing, and the forcible removal of native people, basically erasing them from visibility, basically. And fast forward, Israel has changed drastically in terms of the social movements that dominated that country since the late 40s. And, you know, you had a situation in the 60s, where late 50s, early 60s, where Israel was really a kind of a socialist, you know, kibbutz haven full of idealists, where people had a kind of national identity. And the Zionist part wasn't so pronounced. Although the Zionist ideology was key in creating the State of Israel, the driving force, in fact, at the end of the Second World War. But it changed in the 1980s, drastically, and a new ideology, a new right-wing fascist fervor took hold of that country to bring it to the 24-hour military security state that you have now, which is completely oppressive in ways that the world, this planet, has never seen before. And for a length of time, the oppression's been allowed to carry on for a length of time that we have not seen in modern times. The closest parallel might be, you know, apartheid South Africa, but even apartheid South Africa was not as brutal.
There's so many lies about that. I mean, my God, we've done a couple of shows about that recently, Patrick, and I was floored to find out the immense lies that lie back of all these kind of, these are the mainstream kind of stories that we're getting in the press of how evil these people were, how wicked those were. And I've been floored as we've been looking in and looking more deeply into some of these issues. And I mean, that's where I think people have to question that. Where does the academic world stand on this? Where do they put you know, the kind of the blame today. And I'm not necessarily saying that, oh, you just walk 180 degrees again and you get all the right answers. But it's definitely obvious to me anyway that we have the history is full of, it's built on lies, you know, and I think people would do really good in question these kind of long-standing like pillars of evil that everyone looks towards, because there's much more behind the story than we're being told. That's my point anyway.
Sure. South Africa never deployed the Air Force to flatten townships. And, you know, you look at a situation in Northern Ireland, Catholics and Protestants, and of course the British colonial power in the background. You know, Britain didn't deploy heavy artillery against Catholic council blocks in Northern Ireland. I mean, imagine what would happen if that ever took place. You know, imagine the ripple effect.
Yeah.
But yet that is what we see in Palestine. And Israel's been very clever never to declare its borders. Their borders are wishy-washy. They've never really declared them. Everything in Israel is undeclared, including the nuclear arsenal. By the way, that's another conversation, which we can talk about in a minute. I have something to talk about with regards to that.
Sure, but, yeah.
But we have that situation whereby Israel took the hard right turn beginning in the 80s through the 90s. They had no intention of giving back any land, no intention of pacifying the Palestinians, no intention of giving them any sort of independent state. If they did today, there'd be very little they'd be giving away. but it's all basically parcels and parcels of land that's all separated now. But what they didn't want to happen when they were taking this hard right turn, they realized that they couldn't have a unified Palestine. In other words, they couldn't have the West Bank and Gaza with any solidarity. And so in the late 80s, Israeli internal intelligence Shin Bet created Hamas. Okay.
Yeah.
And this is well documented. Wall Street Journal, Jerusalem Post. Go ahead and do your research on it if you're listening. They created Hamas. And the reason they created Hamas is they needed something to counter the PLO. Okay. And, you know, if you look at the current president in the West Bank, Mahmoud Abbas, these are all people of Fatah. And, you know, even Yasser Arafat, to a large degree, aligned with that term, Fatah. And so then you have this thing in Hamas in the Gaza, which is totally different. The Qassam brigades, militant brigades, the military arm, so to speak, of Hamas, completely radical in comparison to the PLO, very religious. PLO being very secular, okay, Fatah being very secular. So Israel has effectively divided the Palestinians in two with this wedge they created, okay? It's wall-to-wall Hamas. You listen to the radio here, you listen to Sean Hannity, they're running adverts, stop Hamas, sign this petition. I mean, it's ridiculous, okay? Oh, Hamas is going to come across the Texas border, blah, 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 you know, and attack us in America. I mean, the right wing in America is out of control with this Hamas fantasy sort of stuff. But Israel created Hamas. So let me tell you that what makes you think that if Israel created Hamas, it would not have operatives in the highest positions in that organization from the onset? And I'm talking long term. Okay.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
And they would be able to, you know, grandfather certain things down to new plants that come in 5-10 years later, et cetera. And building a network within an organization. And that network can control the organization. And we know this from declassified documents of the IRA. We had number three, perhaps number two within the IRA being British agents. So you're talking about bombings of pubs, shopping malls, and they had full knowledge of everything.
Mm-hmm. Yep.
As it unfolded every year, all the time. That's called controlled opposition. And that's what you have with Hamas. And look at, you know, it's just not a coincidence that you had two very interesting characters. These are top Hamas leaders, Salah al-Ahrouri. He resides in Turkey. He was the first person to come out and say that Hamas operatives were linked to the kidnapping and killing of Israeli teenagers. Surprise, surprise. Isn't that interesting?
Yeah, that's kind of how the whole latest kind of thing. I mean, they changed the objectives of why they bombed Gaza to begin with, but I think this initial thing was due to the three kidnappings of the Israelis, I believe, correct?
Yes. So Saleh al-Ahrouri, he is a Hamas leader who is exiled in Turkey, okay? He, for some reason, was in Syria before the Arab Spring and left and then declared his distaste for Bashar al-Assad. It made him public enemy number one, okay? And Syria has always been an ally of the Palestinian people, by the way, one of the only people that have championed their cause in the region. So here we have a double agent. So al-Ahrouri is a double, likely has got all the fingerprints here of a double agent, Israeli Hamas double agent. And he's old. He would have been there from the beginning. There's another man named Khalid Meshal, who was also involved with the Muslim Brotherhood. And we know the Muslim Brotherhood has very deep ties to British intelligence. And he also repeated the three teens mem at that time. So these are, and he's exiled in Qatar. So we have a lot of these potential Israeli agents in leadership positions of Hamas. Now, the paranoia got so bad that only a week and a half ago, I think, Hamas executed 18 leaders in an effort, apparently, to flush out collaborators. Okay.
Right.
Now, that could have been very well the case, or it could have been Israeli collaborators executed 18 genuine Hamas leaders. This is what we're dealing with here. Okay. This is deep, deep spook city. Okay. And it's, of course, you'd expect no less in Israel's backyard. Okay.
Yeah.
And so they launched their rockets. Magically, none of them kill any civilians. Okay, maybe what, one, two, something like this.
Yeah, they're like they're homemade, is like iron, you know, yeah, pipes with you know, fertilizer in them, like, you know.
Yeah, they're the glorified Roman candles.
Yeah,
and magically, they have no civilian casualties, and it's not because of the Iron Dome. Okay, the Iron Dome, which is operated out of Stuttgart, Germany, is supplied and managed and run by U.S. military personnel. Okay, 100%. Yep. Has something like by some people's estimates, I've seen as low as 38% kill rate. So it's not because of the Iron Dome. So three civilians, thousands and thousands of rockets, no one dies, essentially. And so Israel unleashes firestorm of hell and won't stop until they've hit their quota. I before it started, I said their quota was 1,500. I said they'll stop at that point. They went a bit farther. I think it was 2,200. But I had seen from past sieges of Gaza that they would get that number of 1,000 or 1,500, and before they would stop, because when you get that number, that basically pacifies certain people in the Israeli side, which view the Palestinians as cockroaches. And I'm using this word, which was said to me by Israelis, okay?
Oh, that's so probably one of the nicer things some of them
I'm
have said.
I'm not making it up. So they see them as infestations, subhuman. And to them, to wipe out a few thousand of them means that they'll even say that, that means that at least those 2,000 won't be able to breed. So we've really cut back on maybe potentially 100,000.
But this is the mentality, Patrick, that comes out of their religious scriptures. The Talmud is full of this stuff. I mean, and I think that's kind of why I brought in a little bit, and you might get to that, so I don't want to run ahead of myself here a little bit too, but that's why I think, that's why I brought in the religious aspect, because I think that this is actually largely, you know, part of some of the kind of mental makeup in the background for the reasoning of this kind of stuff. And it's not really seen as, it's not really about, you know, upholding human rights or not, for example. You know, this is just about kind of fulfilling a really, a religious goal, really, which is kind of steeped in religious texts and scripture, which is fervently talk about, you know, murder, the, you know, those who are, you know, unfit, or this group or that group. And I think that that has kind of created some of this environment. What do you make of that?
Maybe it has. I mean, it's hard to prove, you know, how much effect the Talmud scripture has on every single Israeli. But, you know, the fact of the matter is, what drives this sort of bloodlust is one thing and one thing only, and that's fear. And the hard right, the fascist right in power in Israel, permanently in power, has achieved this idea, this level of fear. And they do it, and it's cultural now. It's completely embedded through Israeli culture. It's told to kids as young as they're able to understand words.
That, oh, definitely. Exactly.
That Palestinians are basically animals. They'll kill you if you see them. And et cetera, et cetera. And it's, and the fear that they've created, and that the Israeli state itself creates to justify the industries. I mean, we're talking, you pull the military industrial complex out of Israel, and you have a backwater. You have an economic backwater. You have Yemen.
Yeah. Well, look at how much money they're getting to from Germany and from Europe and from America, military aid. I mean, the reparations here to Israel, it's monumental, amazing amount of money, you know?
It's a welfare state. Israel is a military industrial welfare state. You take that out, and even, you know, Yemen's got a bit of oil. Israel doesn't. But funny enough, when they were herding people down into Gaza, and they drew the lines initially of the Gaza Strip, they had no idea what was off the coast.
There's oil there, right? Isn't it?
Gas.
Okay. Yeah.
Yeah. So, I mean, that's another benefit for Israel, is that they can drive out the population somehow, create such a bad situation that and then negotiate some 11th hour deal a few years down the line with a country like Egypt to resettle these people or whatever. Then they would effectively have the gas rights, and they might get their way. But, you know, at no point in history, if you look at history, it's the very few times when invading group has come in to draw the borders of a country by wiping out the ethnic population, where they were not overrun down the road by that same ethnic population at some point in the future. So again, Israel's destiny is set in stone, and I don't think it's going to be the visions of a greater Israel that they have. I think a lot of that is pure fantasy, and it's mythology. But that is the type of mythology that you need to fundamentally underpin the kind of unsustainable state that you have with Israel, a giant and a welfare state as well. But they also have something in Israel which is called the Samson option. And the Samson option was a war game scenario drawn up by, I don't know the name of the person in the Israeli Defense Ministry, but it was that if things were going wrong for Israel, in other words, if it was being overrun, it would launch nuclear, it would unload its nuclear arsenal to a series of targets in a kind of a suicide run. It's called the Samson option, and that's obviously taken from the biblical story of Samson,
right? Crushing the temple, right?
took out the pillars of the temple.
Yeah,
but that shows you the psychopathy, and there are extremist, radical, right-wing Israelis who are willing to go that far in order to try to scare people into submission to get their way. And you know, I met some wonderful Israelis. I have some good friends, and I know there's good people there, but I also know that there's this overriding culture of fear there, where people think that they're so far down the road that they can't go any other way.
Well, exactly. I don't know if you ever saw Defamation, pretty good documentary. I brought it up a couple of times in the program already, so sorry if you folks are like getting sick of the story, but nonetheless, it's a really good one from 2009 that showed, and I bring this in because you talk about the climate of fear there, they're programming their young ones like I've not seen anyone else to do. Well, perhaps among the programming of guilt upon the ethnic Germans today as they have to carry the cross of the burdens of the alleged crimes of their forefathers and everything else. But nonetheless, they talked with them when they went to excursions to the, you know, to the camps and all that stuff in Poland and things like that. But they programmed them in such a way that they basically, the Israeli young ones believed that it was basically all of Europe is just full of Nazis and all of them are just like waiting to kill as many Jews as they possibly can. I'm not making this up. This is really what they showed in the documentary, this kind of extreme climate of fear. And I brought this up in the past as well, because it shows, I believe, how it reinforces that, you know, many generations down the line when these you know, guys and gals grow up, they're going to have this in the back of their mind. And I think that this has created an environment where they're ready to do anything they can as a survival mechanism. This is so deeply embedded in them, as you said, that it doesn't really, you know, matter if it comes on the cost of other people or even the murder of them, really. This is, it's so deeply embedded. And since so much of it is lies as well, this would be easy they could easily topple a lot of this stuff, but they don't, because it's so beneficial to the situation of how they want to see Israel operate in the region. Did you ever see Defamation, Patrick?
No, I didn't, but I would like to.
I'll recommend it. I'll send you a link later and take a look at that, because there's some stuff we're going to pull out for that for some other, you know, videos we're working on. But it's a really good example, and I think that explains some of the backdrop towards this. And I don't know how much has gone into, you know, the current leadership, let's say, how much they were programmed and whatnot, but this is definitely something that's in the works. But nonetheless, I didn't mean to cut you off there. Please continue on the Samson option and all that you were talking about there.
Yeah. So, you have the psychopathy, which is evident with the things like the Samson option. But you also have a former defense minister, Odi Yinon, the Yinon plan. And this is actual long-term policy doctrine drafted. I'm not sure what year, but I'm thinking late 1980s or late 70s, early 80s. And the Yinon plan was very simple. The Yinon plan was a long-term plan to basically, one by one, decapitate the leadership in every single Middle Eastern country, aside from the Emirates, but any of the sort of progressive or pseudo-democratic countries. So we're talking about Egypt, we're talking about Syria, Lebanon, Iraq, Iran, and for starters, maybe Libya as well. And if you look at what's transpired over the years, and you have the assassination of Abdel Nasser, who was by far the most feared leader in terms of the West, because he was an Arab nationalist. And if you look at the plan, the NATO or the West or the New World Order plan for the future is they do not want to see strong nation states.
That's right. Exactly.
And Egypt embodied everything of Arab nationalism you can imagine. Strong leader, very well respected. And they took him out and also took out Sadat. But then you look at how many coups we had in Syria to get to the Assad family in power. And right now we see the attempt to decapitate the Syrian government. Lebanon has been done over two or three times. And then also we have the Libyan government, which was basically extracted by force a couple of years ago. So if you look, the Yinon plan and Iraq, Saddam Hussein, he's gone, he's out. So is the Ba'athist party system. So is any real governance or ability to govern or defend the country. So the Yinon plan, if you think about it, it looks like it's really been in play, and it's actually unfolded according to plan. over the last 20 or 25 years.
But is it a little bit late? Because I think that they had this in plan. Wasn't it a strategy for Israel in the 1980s, right? It feels like they're actually lagging behind a bit of how quickly they thought that they could implement this.
Well, the objective of the Enon plan was quite simple, was to create a constant destabilization and environment of chaos throughout the region, whereby Israel would be the only stable nation state.
Right.
And would be touted as the only quote unquote democracy in the region. Of course, it is a democracy, but only if you're Jewish.
Exactly. Yeah.
Just like it was about as much of a democracy as apartheid South Africa. So again, but that's how it's marketed in the West. That's how Sean Hannity portrays it. That's how all the conservative right in America portray Israel as a democracy. But it has gone to plan. That's exactly what we see today. So whatever you think about whether this plan was operational, but we can look at the results, and that's exactly what we've got. And so we've got a polarity in the Middle East. And if you take all the Christians out of the picture, then you've got true polarity. And that's where we're at right now. And I dare say that current trajectory that is inching towards some sort of a major breakdown. And
That's very interesting, Patty. Let me ask you here quickly before we continue that. There's two points I wanted to get to. I heard it was another guest we had on who mentioned that this is also partially about trying to get as many Jews as possible to go back to Israel, to go to Israel as a support mechanism of bringing as many people there as possible. Ergo, you have seen some scenarios popping up, for example, in like Swedish towns like Malmö, for example, where the huge Muslim population have been going after the Jews in the town, and you know, alleged crimes of anti-Semitism is on the rise in a country like Malmö, despite that we have, you know, Jews like Barbara Spector, you know, aiding and doing as much as she can to bring in as many immigrants as possible as she can into Sweden and into Europe. She has government funding from the Swedish state. She's behind an organization called Paideia. I've talked about it in the past. I urge people to look into that and see what the equation is there. But if we look at some of that and analyze some of that deeper, it could be, you know, partially kind of makes sense to a certain extent that they're trying to kind of create conditions in Europe that are very ripe with cultural and religious conflict and ethnic conflict, which would result in a lot of the Jewish diaspora to actually return back to Israel or go to Israel for the first time. What do you think? Is that something that they have in the works and in the plan?
Well, that what you just said makes a lot of sense, because as you know, if you know Israelis over the years, they are constantly those who go to and from Israel are constantly trying to promote it as a holiday destination. They're constantly trying to convince other Jews to go there. But if you're a middle class or you're European educated, and you're sort of half secular, it's not a very attractive destination. It's actually a lot of Israel when you go to see it. It sort of looks nice in the pictures, but some of it's a dump.
Yeah.
You know, it's kind of it doesn't have a lot of appeal outside of it being a pure Jewish country. But so it's a hard sell. And you really, a lot of Jews will go to Israel out of kind of duty each year in order to bring money to hotels and to the tourist industry to help the Israeli economy. They feel like that's one of their duties that they have to perform annually.
Yeah.
And there's also good networking there and family connections and so forth. But at the end of the day, it's not a very nice destination. You're basically locked into a very small mass of land. It's a 24-hour, completely locked down police, military security state. It's not particularly, it's crowded. There's not a lot of great things. And of course, if you're one of the Ashkenazi or Hasidic settlers that are pushed out onto the extremities into places like the West Bank, living in forts, basically hill forts, with the IDF providing protection, it's that's one thing. you know, maybe they have very strong religious convictions to be out there, but
right.
At the end of the day, it's a hard sell. So how do you make that hard sell easier? Well, if conditions get very bad in Europe, then that hard sell becomes an easier sell, doesn't it?
So yeah, it sure does. Exactly.
I can see a lot of sense with that. Huh. Because I know a lot of Jews that do not like to go to Israel. They feel like they're being forced. They're not particularly keen on it. They'd rather go to the Maldives or the Seychelles rather than go and take their holiday in Israel. So many of them.
Yeah.
So it is a tough sell. Creating ethnic division and agitation in Europe is definitely one thing that could increase the numbers.
Interesting. Yeah. Very, very interesting. What do you think of Russia in the equation when it comes to Syria and them having previously managed to thwart some of these kinds of invasions, and now it seems potentially that they're not going to be able to do that? I know that Assad recently spoke like, yes, we want to work together with you, you know, America, but if you send your fighter jets in and start bombing, we're going to see this as an aggression. What is Russia going to do here as a kind of a prime previous partner and backing up Syria in the past? And how will this escalate, do you think?
Well, that was one of the main features of what you saw in the Maidan starting in December in Kiev. It was an absolute follow-up to what didn't happen in the end of August and early September. And we're talking about Western airstrikes on Syria. Russia had stopped that and had provided the solution for the chemical weapons issue. So Russia was at hero position, leading the diplomatic groups and respected by all. The beacon of performance in the UN was Russia 1 year ago. What they did is a slow campaign, which was a multi-pronged campaign, which had to start in the Maidan, obviously, and also at the Sochi Olympics by portraying Russia as an anti-gay country.
Mm-hmm. Oh, yeah. That was funny watching that. God.
That was a massively coordinated PR campaign, which was done at very high levels. And then we had February in Kiev, and where basically a fascist neo-Nazi coup took government by force. In Kiev. And so it forced the people of the Crimea to make a snap decision. They, being mostly Russian and Crimea itself being part of Russia only a few decades ago, made a snap decision to say, do we want to be affiliated with what's going on in Kiev? Because it doesn't look good. And they did. And they had a referendum, 90%. That one's closed. Case closed. There's never been a more pronounced demonstration of democracy in our modern history than what happened in the Crimea on March 5th. But that was used as the shoehorn to put Russia into the doghouse internationally. They claim they invaded them, took over their sovereign territory of Ukraine, et cetera, et cetera. Okay. All that was an act of self-determination, but it was spun as an act of aggression by Russia. Okay. And so the whole point of this exercise is to remove Russia from the international scene as a broker. And so what they've effectively done is they've taken out Syria's only main ally, which was Russia. Only Russia would stand up for Syria. And so they've done that. It's done now. Russia can't move, can't do anything. Plus, they're hamstrung in eastern Ukraine. They just reported today that there's 5,000 Russian troops in the Middle East. I mean, if you turn on the TV any given day, you'll get some bombastic lie with some satellite photographs that claims of its evidence. You don't know what's what half the time, especially if it's coming out of the U.S. media, or in this time it was out of Britain.
Mm-hmm.
So they've sidelined Russia, and I believe that the timing of this is to create a new scenario where Russia cannot move. If Russia makes any move towards Syria, it'll be seen as some kind of an international war crime to aid Syria. That's how it will be portrayed.
Interesting.
So they're out of the game. They're completely so.
So tactically, they've lost them. It feels like Russia will have another ace up their sleeve, though, in some capacity, because they've managed. I mean, again, we don't know, but they've managed to overturn some of the previous situations in a quite remarkable way. And Putin and the rest of his folk there have been pretty impressive on the strategic point and in how they've chosen to play the chess game here. You know,
they have, but. But now they're permanently on their back heels, you know, as of March 2014, permanently on their back heels. They can't be on the balls of their feet anymore. And you know, the bigger underlying thing here is also, you know, the deals that Russia had in the works and no longer have in the works. And of course, one of those was a big deal between Russia, Norway, and Iraq. Which was an oil contract, which is effectively not going now. That was a huge, huge, huge deal. But there was some intervention there. And of course, the destabilization in that region. What the West fears most is that Russia becomes a dominant influence economically, trading partner-wise. And of course, after that comes, you know, arms sales. So, you know, we're doing an oil deal together, me, you, and Maliki, and whatever. Well, why not? Do you want some helicopters? Sure.
Right.
You know, and it goes on from there. The West has to flush all Russian ties and influence as much as possible out of that region at 120%. So, and those countries will be left on their own to fend for themselves. And that's a fact. That's what we're seeing right now.
Now, there have been sanctions against Russia for, I don't know for how long this has been kind of, this little game has been starting to play, you know, back and forth like this as well. I don't know how much this is going to, again, lead and escalate the situation, but in what direction do you think that developments will go here if it continues as we see it, you know, the forces, you know, operating and controlling in the Ukraine and everything else are trying to, you know, use this towards their advantage. We know that they want to try to destabilize as many, you know, old Russian satellite states or Soviet satellite states as possible, kind of turning them against Russia. But what do you think is the next step here in the process? I mean, because the escalation in some of these things and even how they interplay with each other could lead to a full on, you know, military intervention. I mean, even neutral Sweden now, I've heard discussions of like, now all of a sudden we need to pour millions into the defense budget again while we're, you know, have been stripping it for, you know, several decades in a row here now. And all of a sudden it's like, all right, we're back on again. We're arming up, you know? So where do you think this will go?
Well, with regards to sanctions with Russia, the main goal there is to isolate Russia financially, but also culturally. And if you notice the last 10 years, how Russia was extending its wings culturally, and you started seeing, you know, Russian personalities in New York and Los Angeles, and there were international travelers, entertainers, financiers, etc. You know, so that Russian culture, Russian brands, Russian products making their way across the world, that's power. That's true, true power, okay? The power to spread the wings of whatever your culture is and to make people recognize it in other countries. And what they've successfully done with Iran, which also has a very strong culture, by the way, is basically bottle it. They managed to bottle Iran for 30 years through sanctions and embargoes. And they've done the same with Cuba, obviously, but, you know, Cuban culture has managed somehow to escape the bottle in its way because of its effervescence that could never be stopped. But Iran has so much to offer the world in terms of science, in terms of research, academia, in terms of oil production, energy, but it's been bottled through severe and universal sanctions. They're trying to build up a similar situation with Russia. Obviously, you're not going to have the same success rate as you do with Iran, because Russia's got a lot of existing links, trade links, and so forth with.
And they're not so politically correct either, which I really like about Russia. They, you know, they've questioned the out of Africa hypothesis. They don't like, you know, they've questioned how the gay issue is being used in the West, for example, for political purposes. They don't like, you know, they forbade the propaganda, which was specifically designed towards, you know, children. So the kind of the, interestingly enough, an old communist country have kind of objected to some of the cultural Marxism that we see in the West now, which is like, I really like that about Russia, you know, they're more ballsy, you know?
Yeah. They're running campaigns telling their young people to have children. Meanwhile, in Europe, our governments are paying for campaigns telling our young people to kill their babies.
That's right. Yep.
So you can see they're not on the agenda at all. The other thing is, in the collapse of the Soviet Union, there was a huge resurgence of the Russian Orthodox Church, Christian Church.
Yep.
And what that provided was it filled a vacuum after the collapse of the Soviet Union. That vacuum was this. It became the mitigating institution that stood between government and the people. And if you look at Europe and what has happened with the church, aside from Italy, okay, and strong in Ireland as well, still a little bit, the church has a very strong position in there, and maybe to some degree, but lessening in Spain and Portugal, the position of the church, the Orthodox Church in Russia, is so strong as a mitigating institution, so much so that the president must go through the church on anything major with any major social implications to consult with church leaders. That does not happen in England. In England, for instance, we have empty churches. They hire their churches out for parties on Saturday night. Okay?
Yep.
And for anything else they can get a buck for, are they selling the land out? There's no one in churches in the UK other than the sort of evangelical churches in South London or North London. But overall, church attendance in Britain is non-existent.
This is all over Europe, I'd say. We have the same situation in Sweden, where the church and the clergy has kind of they've gotten on board on all the PC shit you can imagine. And basically, I think that this ultimately is turning the people, you know, away from it, which I see ultimately as a positive sign if people go back a little bit more to their actually cultural roots and heredity wherever they are in the world. But yeah, that's an interesting point, isn't it? I think it speaks to what has happened in Europe and the devaluation of basically everything that has to do with tradition and culture and faith or some kind of belief or traditional values, basically. And I think that that's the root of a lot of the problems that we see in Europe. And I mean, you're right about the birth rates as well. While that's going down, we're bringing in massive amounts of immigration, replacement level migration almost in some cases. It's a full-on assault and attack on the European psyche. That's what I see.
Yeah, whether you believe in Christianity or not, the fact that it's been removed from Europe means that there's a void there. That means the state has direct access to the brains of their population. There's no one to negotiate with there. They're straight in and they've got you. And you don't have that in Russia. And it makes for something, a very unique culture, which is maybe something very, in a way, a retro progressive culture that maybe we saw possibly building in Western Europe in the 20th century. That sort of revolution is happening in Russia. And the EU technocrats do not like any of it, okay? They don't like any of these things because they don't want to see a strong family unit. They want individuals dependent on the state, nothing else.
Yeah.
Okay. And so Russia cannot be folded into the EU in its current form. It must be broken down to mirror more of what's going on in Western Europe. So they need to rip the soul out of that country first, before they can incorporate it into the European Union. And I believe this is a long-term plan. And NATO is playing a central role in this. Of course, you have the media aspect of it as well, and also, you know, the brain campaigns for all the various lifestyle choices and lifestyle issues that are fed into our children at younger and younger ages.
Yeah.
In Western Europe.
So. Horrendous, absolutely horrendous, and I can't believe that more people don't see through how this being used or so manipulated by you know, the emotional aspect of, you know, of minorities or someone being suppressed or whatever, but they don't see how it's being used in the larger picture. And again, as you say, it's to devaluate the spirit of things. But see, this is still what's happening, you know, kind of above in the top layer, how they're trying to, they're forcing it from the top down. And it's never really going to reach, I believe, the full context of people. That's why we're seeing a response to a certain degree, which I actually very much welcome when we see, you know, parties are actually, they're pro-European, but they're anti-the European Union. You know, right. You see it in France, in England, and I was like, great, finally, something is happening on that front where there is more of a kind of a stronger, you know, traditional values and everything else. And I'm really glad to see some kind of opposition to the European Union, you know?
Yeah, and that's a little sophisticated evolution going on there, which is definitely welcome. In other words, it's not just taking the black and white paradigm. You know, it's either this or this. It's looking at the nuances of this thing with identity, with regards to, you know, people in Europe. So I think this is a great thing, and I think if we start seeing more of this, this might eventually become something serious to contend with. As a political force or an ideological force in Europe?
I think so, definitely, exactly. We see a tremendous, you know, rise of this in a lot of European countries. And I try to tell people as well that look at how the media are treating this. You can tell by the very obvious opposition what they don't want. And I think as well, the more they keep the lid on this thing, the more they try to suppress this. I mean, we have an election coming up in Sweden here. And for example, the Swedish Democrats, who are a very, very mellow party, they have the establishment are fanatical about doing everything they can to destroy them in every capacity that they can. They even have that all the other parties who are allegedly even political, you know, enemies to a certain extent, are ganging up with each other against this one party, and consequently, it just continues to grow and grow and grow. So I think it's a sign of something really, really good, a kind of an awakening to those aspects, you know?
Yeah. Yeah. As long as it doesn't fall into the fascist trap, then it can be very positive, very positive indeed, as an alternative, you know, a genuine alternative. I think that's what a lot of people are hungry for right now, is a genuine alternative. In the UK, we saw the rise of UKIP, which has been extraordinary, but not that I'm a subscriber to UKIP or believe that they are the answer, but I can recognize that UKIP's popularity is based on the fact that people wanted an alternative that seemed to have some kind of a voice on a local level. And that's what UKIP is. And so that's why they're getting the votes.
Yeah.
So something else similar could spring out of that, or UKIP could take a fascist turn, who knows. But
let me ask you a little bit more while we're on the subject of England here. If you looked into the Rotherham thing and everything, it's very, very telling in terms of another, you know, horrible, borderline satanic aspect of political correctness that the police, you know, council officials and the authorities in this, you know, fairly small town, city, what have you, actually turned the other way and refused to recognize the over 1,400 primarily white British girls who were sexually, you know, abused and everything else in this Pakistani-run sex ring, where the pedophile networks have, of course, been operating in Britain for a long time. But this is a huge deal, and the way that they put the lid on, because of the fact that they were so afraid of being called, you know, racist. And I mean, I can't even fathom. I can't wrap my head around the insanity behind this, and the fact that people are so afraid of being called a word and consequently decide to sacrifice, I mean, girls as young as 11 years old into these horrible, horrible conditions. I mean, where the hell are we? What the hell is this about, Patrick? You know?
Well, there's almost, I don't know if it's the same case or an identical case, which took place in Leeds a few years ago. Pakistani men running trafficking white young girls to pedophiles. And that was buried because in the discovery of the initial investigation came up some high-ranking police officers as being involved in the operation, the illegal operation. So, but they again painted it in the public as they didn't want to rile up the Muslim community there. It was too risky, so we had to bury it. But it really wasn't that because of that. It was because of the fact that there were some high-ranking police people involved, and that would have been absolutely unbearable in terms of public confidence. So I'm wondering if there's not this sort of aspect lingering in this particular Rotherham case. But I will tell you that yes, that's how far political correctness will go to the point where someone who is absolutely guilty of a horrific crime can almost walk free or undetected because of the racial political correct fallout. I'll give you a perfect example, Henrik. During the London riots, I believe it was 2000, summer of 2011, which I was in the middle of, by the way. I knew that a few days after the Brixton riots, there were people traveling to Clapham High Street, which is a major street in London, and were setting buildings on fire. And police were given stand down orders not to interfere, not to intervene. Mm-hmm. Why? Because they thought that if the sight of a police officer converging or coming down on a black youth could set off a bigger powder keg. So they just stood down.
Oh my God.
And they burned the high street, and we watched it burn. And that is the
remarkable.
That is the worst level of political correctness. Like Rotherham, that shows you how bad it can get.
Yeah. I said Rotherham. Sorry, it's Rotherham. Exactly. That's correct. Well, it's just extraordinary. And I mean, you know, folks, if you haven't wrapped your head around this yet, it's time to do that. And listen to the previous show we did with Patrick as well, by the way, on the politically correct matrix. The title of that show, really good stuff. As we were kind of getting deeper into these aspects of the problems that we are facing. But before we wrap things up here, Patrick, let me know if there's anything additional you'd just like to leave us on. Otherwise, please let us know about the website, if there's anything else you have upcoming, or if there's some stories we should look out for in the next few days here.
We're trying to get the website going again. Had a bit of a downturn a little bit because of myself being out of the game, but I do have some evidence about MH17, which I'll probably release on 21st Century Wire. But isn't it amazing how that has been classified, that great event that was supposedly a game changer, has all been wrapped up and sealed and not to be spoken about.
Yeah. No.
And so we've got something we're going to share with the public with regards to MH17. And I will come back on a later date and show you, what we've found, which I think is pretty, pretty compelling.
All right. Very good. The website is 21st Century Wire. I want to thank you so much for your time today, Patrick. I know you're a little bit strained in terms of your voice and whatnot, but I hope you feel better and keep up the good work. And thank you for sharing your perspective with us today. We appreciate it.
Thank you so much, Henrik.
All right. As we're coming to a close here, I just wanted to mention something about apartheid that Patrick brought up here towards the end. And these are my opinion, folks, not Patrick's. I just want to make that clear. But you might know that Lana spoke with Atti Skutte from South Africa not too long ago. And before that show, we did quite a bit of research on the topic, and we found out that the greatest horror of what occurred is what's happening right now with the ongoing genocide of the white South African farmers. This is, of course, something that is being covered up. The media never touch it. The UN and all other human rights champions and organizations out there and others who put focus on a lot of the atrocities around the world have completely dropped the ball in the most treasonous way when it comes to the Boers. You can go to genocidewatch.org to find out what really actually is going on. And beyond this source and a few brave people who get attacked for just bringing attention to this, not a word have been uttered in the press around the world about the horrors that they experience. Because, it's not politically correct, you see? Because it doesn't matter, because it's white people. Did the media ever try to cover up apartheid? I mean, have the media not been talking about this ad nauseum since 1994? the most beloved terrorist, Nelson Mandela, whose actions led to many, many murders, have been praised like no other by our media and the establishment as the greatest hero ever, right? That should say something. While white South Africans, who, by the way, never stole the land from anybody or murdered blacks, as the lying official stories have led you to believe, haven't been treated fairly at all in the press. Yes, there was separation, but you see, when the Dutch and the German and other settlers arrived in those lands, it wasn't owned by anybody. There were nomadic tribes around in this massive, massive piece of land. And, I mean, think about it. We know that the media and our dear governments are lying about practically everything. But all of a sudden, we are to believe the official story without questioning any of it, just because it is over a sensitive issue that, yes, involves race. This is, frankly, childish and based solely on fabrications and lies. There was not a great murdering of blacks by whites. But on the other hand, there have been financing, for example, of the ANC by my government, Sweden, in the 80s, unfortunately, that exacerbated the situation with the African National Congress, the Communist Party. Now, whatever you believe or whatever you might have heard, I again will have to challenge your beliefs and what you've been told, and that you take the time to listen to the program with Atti Skutte on Radio 314 to hear from a voice that I bet you've never heard about before on this issue. You definitely never will get a voice like this in the rest of the media or much of the alternative media either. You can go to radio314.com and just scroll down and listen to that show with Atti. The only atrocity that's going on here right now is that of the genocide of the Boer people in the region. The targeting of white South African farmers strictly on the basis of revenge and on a racial basis, that's what's going on. And this is the ultimate racism, and the PC media in the West says nothing about it because it's happening to whites. And some people I've seen online and whatnot, they actually think that children, women and men actually deserve to be mutilated in the most horrible ways possible. Again, I challenge you to go to genocidewatch.org and read there more about the situation. There is an estimated 20 murders per day along these racial lines. Shouldn't this type of violence and murder be highlighted, no matter what, color the people have? Anyway, I just thought I wanted to let you know for the sake of accuracy in this conversation, and I think that it's a shame to compare Israel and the Jewish population there to white South African Boers, because if something like this that is happening now to the Boers was happening to Israel, can you imagine the response in the media? My God, see, we wouldn't, there wouldn't be anything else on TV. I mean, do you remember when these three Israeli kids were kidnapped or teenagers? It was wall-to-wall coverage. There was nothing else going on. All right. Anyway, I wanted to thank you for listening today, ladies and gentlemen. I also want to say thanks to Patrick Henningsen again for joining us and sharing his perspective with us on ISIS and coming on the program. And I want to thank you for joining us here in the members section. My thanks to the Red Ice team. We'll be back with more on Monday with Gordon Kennedy. Then we have Nora Gedgaudas, David Eberhard, Mike King, the guys from Joy Camp, John DeNugent, and many more. Have a great weekend, and we'll speak more to you soon. Take care.